You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives.
Oh, we're a little tighter this week. That's good.
And I'm Sam Abual Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
All right. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. Let's get to what we're driving to. It's hot in here, so I want to go. So let's talk cars. What's in our garage? Sam, you go first.
All right. I had the 2020 Chevrolet Corvette Stingray Coupe. Which is, unicorn of automobiles that everybody's been dreaming about for probably close to 60 years now. And it's finally real, the mid-engine Corvette. Don Sherman, has been writing about this thing since the early 1970s. And it seemed like every few years, GM was finally going to pull the plug and actually build a mid-engine Corvette. They kept bringing out concept after concept, but they never did it until now. And it's good. It's really good. As cars of this type go, it's an amazing bargain. Yeah, I think all of us were kind of shocked last summer when they revealed this thing and said, yeah, it's going to start at $60,000. And the next closest thing you can get to a car like this, is something like the Acura NSX or the Audi R8, both of which, the NSX starts at about 160 now. I think the R8's about 140 or 150 these days. So this is less than half the price of those cars and easily offers comparable performance to those vehicles or to, almost anything else shy of, of like the really high-end hypercars. The one I had was a base model with all-season Michelin Pilot Sports, so not even summer tires. And I took it out, had it in sport mode. I didn't put, not even in track mode. I didn't use launch control or anything. I just put it in sport mode so I could get the timer up. And I was on a rural road, nobody behind me, on a slight uphill slope. And I just stepped on the gas and it went from 0 to 60 in 3.3 seconds. Wow. And this is, straight out of the box.
Well, and I kind of love just the fact that they gave you a base model. That's awesome.
I think they should. Yeah, I think it's great that they're giving out. I know Stephen Ewing had a base model too. And I think it looks and feels, well, you'll have to tell us about the feel, but it looks great in base model form. How does it feel?
It feels great. I know Tim Stevens from CNET, from Roadshow, had a Z51 last week. Jill Simonello had a Z51 in Chicago as well. But, this base one, there's not a whole lot of reasons to upgrade. The only options on the car I had were the performance exhaust, which is like $1,200, and the $400 torch red seatbelts. So the seatbelt color matched the body color. No other options on
there. But it says so much about their confidence in the vehicle that they're willing to put that trim into the press fleet.
That car is bad.
Yeah, I mean, we almost never get base models of anything.
Right.
Even, even entry-level cars. It's always, the mid-level to premium models.
Well, and somehow I swung an invite to the launch out in Vegas, and they had base models there for us to drive as well. The one that I drove was 85,000, so clearly not the base. But just the fact that they had people in them just says a lot. It really is. It has to be respected.
Yeah, and to, you know, to be fair to Chevrolet, right now there's only one powertrain option. So you know, regardless of whether you get the base model or the top trim level, you're still getting the same 495 horsepower, 6.2 liter small block, latest generation of the small block, and that 8-speed dual clutch transmission. So that's in all of them right now. Next year, there's a Z06 coming, which reportedly will have a flat plane crank V8, similar to the one that's in the C8Rs that are running in the IMSA Sports Car Championship this year. But aside from that, there's you know, the only other real performance changes to, you know, that are available right now are, you know, in the Z51 package, you can get the Magna Ride dampers, and you can get upgraded, you know, you can get summer tires, and I think there's a 20-inch wheel option. You know, but then, you know, there's a bunch of other options you can get as well, but they don't really impact the performance of the car. You know, so basically, you know, even at the base level, you're getting the same level of performance, which is pretty remarkable. And unlike the first Corvette I ever drove was actually just about 30 years ago. When I was still, when I just started working as an engineer, I was working for GM at the Milford Proving Grounds, and you know, I had a chance. I went along, accompanied a car from our team, a Lotus Esprit Turbo, from the group that I worked in, for a benchmark drive that the Corvette team was doing.
Oh, I bet the Corvette murdered it.
Not necessarily. you know, they had the C two C4s, a base Z51 C4, and the LT5 ZR1, which had the Lotus twin cam V8 in it, and they also had an Acura NSX, which was the only time I ever drove the first gen NSX. But you know, those cars, those C4 Corvettes, were such crude beasts in those days. They had a big clamshell hood, you know, so the whole front half of the car basically flipped up. And when you're driving down the road, you could see the whole thing shaking. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the GM charm.
Yeah. Well, this car, it's, you know, just feels so sophisticated. I mean, it's solid as a rock. You know, even with the top off, the roof panel off, solid as a rock. You know, no vibration, no flexing that you feel at all. Even without the Magna Ride dampers, the ride quality was actually surprisingly good. I mean, it's not, you know, Genesis G90, you know, smooth, you know, soaking up all the bumps.
I would hope not.
But it wasn't punishing either. You know, I mean, it was quite a comfortable ride. This could easily be a daily driver, because that was one of the questions that somebody posed on Twitter. Could this be a daily driver? And I think absolutely it could be. And it's also got a surprising amount of cargo space between the front trunk and then the rear. Just for giggles, I opened up the rear and just to see if I could fit my inflatable paddleboard in the back. And I actually could. I put my stand-up inflatable paddleboard in the rear trunk and closed the lid, and it fit perfectly.
But how much does it tow?
Nothing. You cannot hook up a trailer,
but it does so, haul ass.
It does haul ass.
Now, so, know, and oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The you know, the seats in this thing are great. I'm still, shall we say, unconvinced about the whole wall of buttons.
That's
thing.
What I was going to ask
I think,
you.
I think that was a stupid design decision. I think that if anything, they should have cut that down and just put a panel of buttons next to the touchscreen, the center touchscreen, or because the problem with the way it's set up, that row of buttons, that, you know, the longitudinal row of buttons on there, is they're not really readily distinguishable without looking at them. And actually, if you're driving with the roof panel off and the sun is shining down, you also can't see the lights on them to see if they're on or off. And the markings on them are backlit, so they're black buttons with backlit buttons markings on there. So you know, it's actually hard to see what it is you're hitting, you know, when you're trying to, you know, adjust you know, the climate control or anything. So I think it's just not functionally a great design. But that's a relatively minor quibble considering how good everything else is about this car.
So when I drove it, I compared that wall of buttons. It reminded me of like the puritanical beds where they like put like a long pillow or something in between a couple so that they can't touch each other if they're not married yet. Like, wasn't that, we learned it. We learned the term in like studying colonial times, and I just can't remember what it's called, but it's like a bolster, like in the middle. I'm like, there's no hanky panky going on in that Corvette Stingray.
I think it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be a new Corvette if it didn't have a questionable choice of, you know, interior, you know, something.
Fair enough. I mean, I will say that, you know, after a while, so Henry Payne was my driving partner. And, you know, after a while, it does limit it. I mean, it kind of fades away a little bit, but I still felt like I was in the sidecar. Right. As opposed.
Yeah, no, I can definitely believe that.
You know, you're sort of this like, oh, okay. You know, there's a passenger there. We have to make room for them. But
yeah, that's that would definitely be true.
And I also thought it was very ironic that, you know, it's very similar to what Porsche has, like in the Cayenne and the Macan, with all those buttons. And yet the Taycan is like no buttons. Like they've gone completely away from it. So it was just kind of funny to me that all of a sudden Corvette comes out with this, all these buttons, just as Porsche's moving away from them.
But at least they're not like, at least it's not like a touchscreen. At least they're buttons.
Yeah, that's true.
They are
physical buttons, even if they are almost impossible to distinguish from each other by feel. if I was buying one of these, I think I'd probably step up to the 2LT model. Mainly because, you know, in the 1LT, the base model, you don't get any driver assist features at all, which, you know, for the most part is fine. I can do without adaptive cruise control and lane keeping assist and things like that in here. But given the width of this car, you know, and how low you sit in it, you know, and those big rear fenders, I think it would be good. And I think the GM really should have made things like blind spot monitoring standard equipment on the base model. I don't think that should be in the up level trim. I think it should be standard in the base model. And also the rear camera mirror system, I think also would have been helpful.
Yeah.
You know, just for better visibility straight out the back. It's actually, given the size of the back window, you know, over the engine, you can actually see a surprising amount, although you don't see anything over your shoulders. You know, if you glance over your shoulders, you know, the rear three quarters, because you've got huge pillars there. But straight back, you can actually see a surprising amount. But I think I would rather have that camera mirror and blind spot monitors as standard equipment in the base model, given, you know, the visibility challenges of a car of this configuration.
It's so funny, Sam, because I made that exact point that it's a $1,500 rear camera view option that really should be standard equipment, because there isn't a lot of visibility on that thing at all.
No, it's not. But then again, I mean, you can see ahead of you great,
right,
which, given, you know, how fast it goes, is probably all you're ever going to need to see. The roof panel, you know, as Corvettes have been for decades now, you know, it's a target top. So the roof panel is removable, and the roof panel is really lightweight, very easy to, you know, for one person to handle by themselves. You don't need help, you know, very lightweight roof. And then, you can put it in, stash it in the rear trunk, and there's, little pockets there where you slide it into the bottom, into the pockets at the base of the trunk, and then just snap it in at the top so it doesn't rattle around at all. Of course, when you do that, you lose most of that rear trunk space, but you still have the front trunk where, you know, if you're going to the grocery store, you can throw a couple bags of groceries in there, you know, or on a weekend road trip, you know, you can fit a, you know, duffel bag with a few days worth of clothes in there. So, you know, it still remains a surprisingly practical car for what it is.
Yeah,
I love how proud they are of the Corvette, and I think they should be. I think they deserve to show it off, and putting the base model out there just shows how fundamentally good they all are. You know, they had a lot of details to really figure out with making the mid-engine Corvette and making it for the price, and certainly the performance that it delivers. Makes it all worth it. You know, we waited for 50 years for it. It's finally here. And I'm assuming it lives up to the weight. You know, I will have to sort of reserve my judgment for driving it, but I don't know. You guys seem a little bit more lucky out there than I, I am out here. So
I think for the, I think for the most part, people are really happy with it.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't complain, you know, to get a car with this kind of performance. Yeah. And I mean, the design has really grown on me. I actually like this design better than the C7. The C6 is still probably my favorite modern Corvette, but the C7, you know, I was less enamored with it. The design, I always thought the design was a little busy, especially the back end, but this one really works for me.
So Sam,
and I got a lot of comments from people, you know, when I went to the store or just people walking by seeing it in my driveway.
I bet. So Sam, how are sales of it? I don't know if you know off the top of your head.
I don't, you know, it's kind of hard to judge because
they don't really report them.
Basically, well, they do, but it went on sale. Yeah. They report quarterly and it went on sale, you know, in volume in January. They had a few sales in December. And then, you know, January is obviously not the best time for Corvette sales, you know, it's more spring summer car.
Right.
And then, you know, then the pandemic hit. So I think it's hard to judge right now what the sales are going to be. They did cut off orders on the 2020s back in June, because they were basically at that point they had enough to fulfill all of what they were going to do for the 2020 model year. And then they started taking orders for 21 models.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is going to be an interesting year. You know, it's the first year of the car, and there's usually significant changes between, you know, the first year of a new Corvette model and, you know, the subsequent few years. And then it's just going to be a rare car anyway, given whatever else has gone on this year. It's been rather eventful. So I think that the 2020 C8 is going to be a rare car. Whether that means it's more valuable, I don't think is anything we really know. But I think it's going to be one of those cars that you don't see as many of, just because there weren't that many made.
Yeah, well, they. So I just pulled up GM's second quarter sales report. They sold 6,279 in the U.S. in the first 6 months of this year, which is down 35% from last year when they were still selling C7s.
Right.
It was 9,700 last year. But, you know, given the situation, you know, that's about what we would expect.
How many Cadillac sedans did they sell?
three or four.
Less than that. They sold 2,500 CT6s and 5,500 CT5s in the first half.
Yeah, so.
Well, the CT5 is doing better than I thought. I mean.
Yeah, it's doing better than the CTS was last year. CTS did 4,800 in the first half last year, and this is 5,500. So
that is niche model volume.
It's off to a reasonable start.
Good.
That's awesome.
And I'm driving. I actually have the CT5 in the driveway this week, which we'll talk about next time.
All right.
But the other thing about Corvettes is, you know, driven sanely, they're actually surprisingly fuel efficient. This was true of the C6 and the C7 as well. This one, you know, it's rated at 15 city, 27 highway, 19 combined. I actually got about 22 combined, and I was getting about 29 on the highway.
That 15, so, I mean, that's a big gap, 15 to 27, you know, city to highway.
Yeah, it is. Probably something about the way they've got it all calibrated, you know, more for performance than fuel economy. The sticker price was $61,585, including delivery. So that's the base price, plus the $1,200 performance exhaust and $400 torch red seat belts.
That's a ridiculous deal.
That's amazing.
I know. For them. There's nothing even remotely close to that for that price point.
I hope that they send it to me at some point.
No, they're waiting to send you the new ZR1 with the twin turbo V8.
I'll take it. That's fine. My road is relatively straight. I think there's a quarter mile between, maybe a half mile between stop signs. So it's fine. All right. So Rebecca, you were driving something a little bit more sedate, but still a good time. You had the Genesis G70.
I did. You know, this is one of those cars. You know how we always try and like guess how much a car is, right? Like they drop it off and you're looking at it and thinking, you know, we always have a range. But I was really pleasantly surprised having driven this car, having experienced it. Again, like that value, like what you're getting for the money is actually really good with this Genesis G70. I had the rear wheel drive version. It had prestige, so it was more towards the top of the line. Personal pet peeve, I find the Genesis website, the consumer facing Genesis website, really hard to manipulate. So I'm pretty sure it's pretty close to the top of the line. It had a couple of features. It had the Elite package, which was $4,600, and that's the 8-inch touchscreen, power folding, auto dimming outside mirrors. It's got the tilt and telescope steering wheel, heated front seats, which actually comes standard in all-wheel drive, which is nice because that's typically a weather kind of related thing. And then it had really nice quilted leather interior. It also had, so the Prestige package for almost $3,900, that has the heads-up display, which I didn't really find to be particularly compelling. I've had other vehicles like the BMW X5 or X3 that I had that did a heads-up display a little bit better than that. But this had, you know, a variety of really nice features in it. So one of the things that I thought as I'm driving this is just that it's one of those vehicles that if you want it to go fast, it will happily go fast. But if you just want to have a good, solid commuting car that makes you feel like you've earned your keep, this is that car. This, you know, it's about the size of a 3 Series, competes with like the Mercedes 3 Series and the C-Class Mercedes C-Class, BMW 3 Series. But it's just kind of like no drama. Like I sat in it, I started driving it. We were up to triple digits ever so briefly. And then it just was really well behaved. And I appreciate that. Sometimes on really curvy roads here, I could push it and it would respond happily. I had the 2.0 liter. There is the 2.0 liter 4-cylinder inline 4. There is a 3.3 liter V6, which of course is even more fun. But you know, 252 horses, it just did exactly what I wanted it to do. And I just felt really comfortable in it. Almost from the very beginning, things were where I wanted them to be. And I like that kind of experience. I don't want to fight with my car. You know what I mean? Like, so, I was like, this just makes sense.
That's an adventure.
That's the adventure. Yes, there are some weeks when it is definitely an adventure. You're right.
So how does it feel like when you're actually exercising it, right? And you know, through some curves or, you know, making it perform like a sports sedan? Does it feel like all the pieces sort of are connected and talking to each other? Or does it feel kind of sloppy?
No, I found it to be, you know, lunging into a tight turn. It wanted to go there. It was happy to go there. I felt like it was that sports sedan, that everything was tight and with me. And I never felt like, even though it was rear wheel drive, I never felt like I was losing the back end. I never felt like I was, you know, going to have any issues with it. It was just a good car. It was very quiet on the highway when I, you know, at speed, and just fun to drive. It was one of those cars that if you just want to do day to day, that's great. But for those times when you want to blow off a little steam, it will happily be a partner in that crime.
Yeah, I think
there is no crime in blowing up.
There is no crime.
I think taken on its own, it's good and satisfying. I think where I've seen it fall down, because I really liked the G70 and I was impressed with it when I drove it. I had it with the V6, I think, a while ago. But I think where I've been surprised to see it fall down is in direct comparison tests with like the 3 Series.
Well, and I haven't driven a 3 Series or C-Class lately.
Right. And I think that if you drive them back to back to back, the nuance really comes out more. But I was really surprised at like the last sort of car and driver comparison test I read, where the Genesis just got dinged for just not having all the parts, but not doing it as well as the Germans or as well as BMW. The 3 Series won the test because of course it did. But I think
wouldn't be a car and driver comparo if it wasn't. They didn't.
I wonder if it's like, it's actually kind of nuanced differences, or if it's just, you know, the G70 feels good enough most of the time for most of us. And it's that last little bit that the next one will get, you know?
Well, it's funny because I had been, the Car and Driver review that I read actually said that rivals such as the Mercedes C-Class and 3 Series are either not as fun to drive or not as richly appointed and still cost more.
Yeah. All right. Well, so again, it's that classic.
Well, it's an opinion point too, right? Yeah. I mean, I felt
And when you compare the cars as well, you know, like when you're driving them, like you got a group of 4 or 5 cars versus like taking it on its own. I think it is true. Objectively, there's just a ton of value in the Genesis.
Well, and to not keep our listeners any more in suspense. So this had a price tag delivered of under $45,000. $45,000. I mean, that's really good price for.
And how much was that Infiniti Q50 you had the other week?
The Infiniti Q50 was more, I believe. Let me go to my handy dandy.
It seems like it was over 50.
Rebecca
grand.
Drive's website and look. Yeah, I think
that's at RebeccaDrives.com.
Exactly. Oh no,
car reviews in 200 words or less.
60,000.
Oh,
because it was the Red Sport 400. It was 60,475. Now that did have the 3.0-liter V6 engine in it. So the Genesis comparable is probably in that price range. But you know, I can't say that I sat there and thought, "Gosh, I wish I had the Q50." You know, and the other thing,
I don't think anybody's saying that.
The other thing that was interesting that actually just coincidentally came out at the same time was this report by owners of Genesis. So Strategic Vision is a company that actually our listeners, if you bought a new car, you may have gotten a survey from them there. It's a new car buyer survey and they ask consumers, you know, what do they think of their vehicle? But they periodically will do special reports. So this was actually the first Strategic Vision Brand Equity Index. And it asks current and prospective owners how they feel about their vehicles. And so Genesis actually scored the highest of any brand, brand overall for confidence, for smart choice, and for refinement in terms of owner. So the ownership experience that people are having is very, very positive for them. And I thought that was just such great news for people that have a Genesis. It tells us that, you know, that owners aren't regretting their decision. They're really, really happy with it. And, you know, non-owners, of course, Mercedes was number one in terms of overall for confidence and for refinement, but that's a perception. What's interesting about the ownership is that's their reality. That's how they feel in their vehicles. And so I thought that was just really such great news for Genesis as it continues to define itself, to get itself on the map. And I think we've said all along that the products are there. It's just that they've got to work on the brand perception, and their current owners can really be advocates for the brand to improve on the sales and perception.
Well, somebody has to be an advocate for the brand because, you know, there's not that many dealers and, you know, they're kind of hard to find. So, you know, if owners are willing to speak up, and, you know, we've certainly seen the power of, you know, voice of the owners or just customers, the testimony for a car when you look at a brand like Tesla.
Yes.
You know, Tesla doesn't do any traditional advertising, you know, and they rely completely on, you know, the voice of the community to amplify, you know, the message of the company. And it's worked great for them. So hopefully it'll work for Genesis as well.
But Genesis, the one thing that they're missing is Genesis doesn't have a figurehead at the top of that brand doing outrageous shit all the time, keeping them in the news, getting all kinds of earned media.
Yeah, that is very true.
Genesis needs to work on that for sure. That will help a lot.
Hire an asshole and you guys will sell more cars.
I think Bob Lutz, you know, would be willing to come out of retirement for that.
That's awesome.
Note that I did not infer that Mr. Lutz
I was not saying that either. I was just saying he could be a great figurehead for the brand.
That's true. That's true. Bob has he's a product guy. He's got a touch. He could probably, you know, be a good advisor for the brand, but I think they know what they're doing. I just think they're also stuck now. They got to slow walk it a little bit. And I puzzlingly, they've got half of it down, right? I'm puzzled that you don't really see or hear about Genesis. They're not tooting their own horn as much as I think they should.
I think part of the problem, you know, is the fact that, you know, they came out with three sedans.
Right. Well, yeah, that's part of it.
They're always still waiting on the GV80.
Right. Which that should was be out any day now.
Other crossovers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, yeah, they pushed back the launch a little bit because of the pandemic. Yeah. But it should be coming out in the next few weeks or a month or so.
So I think, I don't know how when they decided to split off and make Genesis its own brand, like they've had some lead time. I don't know how they got stuck with three sedans, why they didn't.
Well, there was a lot of internal politics. I mean, because sedans rule the day in Korea. Right. And so when you're on the streets of Seoul, a Genesis is like a Mercedes over there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and there was a lot of back and forth when it came to the dealer network, they only gave the brand to certain dealers, and then they wanted them to have their own dealership. And I mean, it was just, there's been a lot of angst and internal politics.
Does Genesis exist as a standalone brand in other markets, or is it only here in North America?
I believe it's a standalone in other markets as well. I think it's a standalone in Korea, certainly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if they're still branding them as Hyundais in Korea.
No. Well, and one of the things that was interesting in this, in the G70, is that there's actually seat adjusters built into the passenger side. So as the driver, I can just reach over and I can adjust the passenger side seat so that if somebody's sitting in the back seat, I can move that up easily enough, which is so funny because that's certainly not, I mean, it was convenient for me because at one point my visibility was kind of compromised by just the way that the road was sloping. And I was backing down my driveway, but I just kind of had to laugh because I thought that's never something that you typically see in the States.
Yeah. So this is the thing. This is a fundamental downfall of central planning, right? Like if you want to sell cars in the US, you will sell the kind of cars that people buy in the US.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, they would have had the GV80, especially because Hyundai has such fantastic SUVs. I mean, their SUVs are really, yeah, really good. So they had basis, yeah, for them. And just on a structural note, Kia, even though they're owned by Hyundai, is completely separate in the U.S. So they are a totally separate corporate entity. They're seen as fierce competitors.
From a marketing and retail perspective, they're completely separate.
Right. And they're
from
seen
an
as fierce competitors.
From an engineering perspective, they're very much entwined.
I'm sorry?
From an engineering and product development perspective, they're very much entwined.
Yes, back in Korea they are. But
no, and here, you know, like the Hyundai Tech Center, the Hyundai America Tech Center here, like 5 minutes from my house, you know, they do work on Hyundais and Kias. It's actually the Hyundai Motor Group Tech Center now.
But they are not allowed. I was told by them that they were not allowed to talk to each other, that like the Hyundai people couldn't find out what was in the Kia Telluride.
On the marketing side, they're not. But within the building, there, you know, there might be some divisions, but you know, I mean, they're working on, you know, they're doing the engine work, the chassis development work, you know, all the product development work is happening in the same building for all three brands.
Okay.
That's gotta be weird.
But they were emphatic when we were on the Kia launch for the Telluride that they were a separate company.
Oh, yeah. And they always remind us of that, you know, anytime that we slip and say, you know, refer to, you know, the Optima and Sonata as being the same car, or, you know, the Elantra and the Forte, you know, or, you know,
or the Telluride and the Palisade.
And the Telluride. Yeah.
Yes. But so I think, you know, They have, Genesis has had a very rough start, and they've had the core group that they had in place, I should say, with people like Manfred Fitzgerald, who came over from Lamborghini, and he was the president for a number of years. He's out now. And then Luke, I was going to say Luka Doncic, not the basketball player.
Yeah.
Thank you. But, you know, he's now retired or left the company for personal reasons. And it's really unfortunate because I think that there's some, you know, they had a really solid vision and wanted to execute that vision. And I think we're starting to see that with some of the products coming out, but there definitely is, you know, it'll be interesting to see what Mark Del Rosso does at the top now with his experience at the brand. So see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I drove a car that has a very strong brand and a very strong image, and they sell the hell out of it. I had the Jeep Wrangler, Jeep Gladiator Mojave. So I was also in a $60,000-something vehicle. And Sam, you had this not too long ago.
About a month or so ago.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with the Mojave. It's different than the Rubicon. You know, it's got the Fox shocks with the remote reservoirs, and they're really great at soaking up like small high frequency stuff. So it actually rides with a lot of discipline, and it feels better the faster you go, which that's the point. It's kind of
it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's a good sort of compact pickup. It has a decent tow rating. Dressed up in the Mojave trim, it's nice inside. This one had leather seats, and they charge you $500 extra to put sound insulation on the top of the top of the Freedom Top, you know. And you have having a vehicle like this in the summer, in late summer, is just, it really doesn't get much better than that, you know. I'm not really a convertible guy, but it's nice, you know. You pop off the top sections, and you roll down the windows, or if you're real ambitious, you take off the doors, and you just drive around on a warm evening. There's quite a lot of charm to that. And that's, I think, what really stands out with the Gladiator is the personality they've got in this pickup. Because it starts off more expensive than every other mid-sized truck, and it stays more expensive.
By a pretty wide margin.
Yeah, the delta isn't that big to begin with. I think if you were to buy a Ranger, you can get into a four-wheel drive sort of crew cab short bed Ranger for about 30-31, and the Gladiator, I think the cheapest Gladiator is going to be about 35, and then the Colorado is like right in the middle, so the cheapest Colorado is going to be like 33-32, something like that. So it's not that far off. If you're leasing or borrowing, it's, you know, you'll get there. You could probably swing it if you wanted to stretch a little bit, but nobody's buying the base model. and B, like it's nicely equipped, you know. It has four wheel drive. It comes with the V6. It can tow, if you get it configured correctly, I think it can tow 7,650 pounds, which is the top of the class, or GM may have fiddled with the Colorado to get it to 7,700. So they can claim that has the best in class towing now. That's like, it's pretty good. It's functional. Until you go to like use it.
What do you mean?
We have the power went out the other day, a couple weeks ago. You and I, Rebecca, yes. We both lost power for a while.
Yes.
So I borrowed my brother-in-law's generator, and it's an 8,500 watt generator. The thing is heavy. And I wanted it back at his house so that it didn't become a theft target at mine. And I'm just like scratching my head trying to figure out, how am I going to get this into the bed of the Jeep, which is
fairly tall liftover height to get anything into the bed.
But it's got the one that I had a 5-foot bed.
Yeah, well, the bed itself is a decent size. Like, that's okay. Good. You know, right.
It's just the height of it.
It's high up off the ground.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's an extra inch off the ground in the Mojave. So I'm like looking around like, what do I have? I had to actually tack together a quick like set of, you know, a quick ramp out of like some 8-foot lumber I had kicking around, like some 4x4s, and so just ridiculous. My 12-year-old's like, Dad, you should really just call him and have him come help you. I was like, no. We're going to figure this out. Dan. We're going to engineer this. I'm going to throw a come along over the tree branch. Yeah. So that's problematic though. Like it's tall and like, even to get in, you got to like, you know, for those of us of
getting in was
stature,
definitely exciting sometimes.
Yeah. You've got to sort of like pull yourself. You could, you know, good bicep sort of, you know, strength on that grab handle. But that's, I think also that is part of the charm. I did like it quite a bit. It's a, one of those cars that if you want value, no, unless you're talking about resale. And it's going to hold on to its resale value, but I have a hard time buying a car to sell it. So that doesn't really factor in for me. Initially, you are going to pay for the privilege of having the Gladiator. It generates goodwill, so that's nice. You know, I heard more than once, you know, somebody commented as we drove by, like, "Whoa, a Jeep truck." So that's cool. It's still new enough that it excites people. I don't want to pay for that every month, though.
It was funny because my brother flew in from California last week, and he drove down and he said, "Hey, can you meet me at this other airport so he could drop off his rental car because he didn't need it?" And it was a Jeep Gladiator.
Really?
It's a rental? The rental fleet.
Wow.
But what was also
which fleet?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. But what was also kind of interesting is that he didn't really rave about it. He was like, I was like, "Why don't you keep that thing? Like, I wanted to keep it for the week." And he was just like, it was fine. Like he didn't really go on and on about it, which was kind of interesting because he's driven other products for me, you know, as like if he's visiting or something, and I always get clearance from the manufacturer. But it was just kind of interesting that he didn't really rave about it, because I think it's great fun.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a fun car. And I think that dressed up like the Mojave, it definitely has the goods too. You know, it's got Dana 44 axles. It's got the 2-speed transfer case and the locking rear axle. And you can seriously, you know, do a lot of off-road on this. If it's going to be used like a lot of Jeeps are, never taken off-road, it's kind of a shame and a waste, but yeah, I mean, you're free to buy whatever the hell you want. And it's a big personality vehicle, just like a Raptor.
I actually like it better than the Raptor.
I do too.
You know, as something to drive around, because like you said, the suspension setup is so much better. It's so much better controlled than the Raptor. The Raptor feels kind of soft and floppy on the road.
Yeah. And the Raptor is, it's a Ford truck.
I haven't driven the Raptor, but I drove the Ranger.
Don't let Mr. Levine hear you say that.
Well, they're good trucks. I just don't like them that much.
I drove the Ranger at an IMPA event and it was not okay.
Really?
Really?
What didn't you like about the Ranger?
It was really loud and very rough, and other people agreed with me. I was like, no.
I think part of the problem with the Ranger is that it only has the 2.3 liter EcoBoost in it, which is a powerful enough engine. You know, it's actually more powerful than the engine that's in the Gladiator, I think. But it's
got more torque. I think it's got in the truck, it's got a little less horsepower, because I think it's like 275 or something.
Oh, okay. I was going to say that's got to be like a 300 horsepower engine, but that makes sense. They traded horsepower.
It is in a Mustang, but not in the Ranger.
you know, and I'm actually surprised how well the Gladiator does with the V6, because it's got 285 horsepower and 260 pound feet of torque. It's not a light vehicle in the first place. So to get to that towing, number where the Gladiator Mojave can only do about 6,000 pounds. Oh, I say only. That's pretty good.
That's sufficient for what most people need for towing. I mean, you know, most people that tow, you know, are towing, you know, maybe a boat, you know, that's typically about between 4 and 4,500 pounds. A trailer a couple of snowmobiles or jet skis or something like that.
Yeah, they'll do a jet ski trailer all day long.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the e-torque system might help fill in the gaps, you know, because the Pentastar, you got to work it a little bit here. So the e-torque might help. The diesel's coming. I don't think the rumor is the diesel's not going to tow anymore, because they've just got to figure out how to package all the stuff in the front of it. So it's going to lose some cooling. So the heat is a problem with the diesel when you
tow. Well, if you can't tow with the diesel, then there's no point in getting the diesel at all. Yeah, I mean, that's the point of getting a diesel,
right?
In a
truck like that. Well, it'll tow more efficiently, but David Tracy had an interesting write up about it. One of the problems with the Gladiator getting over that 6,000-pound tow rating to get to 7,650 was that there's just not a whole lot of space on the front of it to package. Oh, okay. A thicker radiator, a larger radiator, more ducting, something, they had a real challenge getting enough heat out of the cooling system. And they got there with the gas engine. But the diesel has a charge air cooler and it's got to go somewhere. And so that takes up space.
And one of the things that they've talked about with the Gladiator, one of the differences between the Gladiator and the Wrangler, if you look at the grill, it's actually the same grill, except on the Wrangler there's like a chrome trim bezel around the interior, around the perimeter of each of those slots.
Yep.
And on the Gladiator they actually removed that to make those slots just slightly wider and taller, get a little bit of extra airflow in there to get the cooling they needed for the Gladiator.
Yep.
which they didn't need on the Wrangler.
And part of it too is like it's gaming tests, like fuel economy, because they're doing the SAE towing test. It's a combo of cooling and gearing and which gear the engine is in, so which RPM it runs at depending on how much heat it's going to generate. So it's fascinating, sort of deep nerdy engineering. But yeah, I don't think the diesel's going to do any better in sort of the overall number. It's probably going to tow more confidently. It's just going to feel better. And I think it's probably why you're not going to see a Hemi in here either. It's just, you can't get the heat out of the Hemi either. In that engine bay. So it kind of is what
it's a shame. Cause that, the one thing it could use is a Hemi in there.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's something to be said for like the 1930s theme that the Gladiator pulls off. You know, it feels cozy inside. You look out over that rounded hood with the flat fenders and stuff. It just makes you nostalgic.
Mm-hmm. I like it a lot.
I think it's totally the point. It drives really friendly. It drives way better than it really should for what it is, given the primitive
engineering. Something with two solid axles.
Yeah, and I say primitive engineering, it's actually got a lot of very expensive, fancy modern-day engineering in it to make it behave so well. But it's the worst I can say about it is that it's a serious financial commitment. And so if you can afford it, go ahead.
It's cheap. Of course it is.
It's a member into a club. It's a membership into the club too. So you got to like practice your Wrangler wave. My son was reminding me about that. He's like, that person just waved to you. He's like, ah, shit, I forgot.
since getting my Miata, I've learned to, hit the button on the console to pop up the headlights when I see another NA coming.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah, so I'm not friendly like that. I got to remind myself.
You're a man of the people. How are you not friendly?
It's true. Yeah, I'm like a shop steward. I'm grouchy. I look out for my people, but I'm a grouch about it.
Curmudgeon, get off my lawn.
Exactly. All right. So I think that the Gladiator is a great pickup. I'm glad we have it. It's going to cost you, but nothing else really has that kind of charm. So go for it if you can.
Rebecca, did you have anything else you wanted to add about the Strategic Vision Owner Brand Equity Award?
No, I think it's, I think I said my piece. It's just, again, it's an interesting kind of just another marker that consumers can look at and address and say, you can Google if you're doing your research and say, what Strategic Vision's Owner Brand Equity Award? And then you get a good idea of the ownership experience for some of these people.
Okay. Well, there's another award that also came out from J.D. Power. Not so much an award, I guess, but they measured the Technology Experience Index. And, they sent out surveys to, customers of, all the major brands and did scoring on categories including effectiveness, innovation, and customer reception. And interestingly, the it had a total maximum score of 1,000. Only one brand got over 600, and that was Volvo. We got 617.
That is fascinating.
Everybody else went down from there.
Yeah, it's infuriating. Don't encourage them.
Yeah. And then second on the list was BMW.
Another fascination.
With 583, Cadillac at 577, Mercedes-Benz at 567, and Genesis at 559. And one of the things in this article that's mentioned, Tesla isn't on the list, and it's for the same reason that Tesla is typically not on the quality surveys, the JD Power quality surveys, because what JD Power does, they send out these surveys to people who have bought cars from these brands, and they have to get the customer data from the manufacturers. Or in some states, they actually get the customer data, the registration data from the state DMVs. But in some states, they're required to get permission from the manufacturer to contact their customers. And Tesla does not allow, in those states, there's 15 states where that's required. Tesla has never allowed JD Power to actually contact its customers where permission is required.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Tesla is also not good at contacting its own customers.
Well, that is very true. So Tesla didn't get an official score, but in the 35 states where they were able to survey Tesla customers, they got a 593 score, which would have put them in second place behind Volvo, which is interesting. The tech that customers liked and didn't like, they were still uneasy about automated driving systems. And, I guess in this case, it's ADAS. And last week, TU Automotive put on a virtual conference. They did a combination of several of the conferences that they're responsible for, like the annual TU Detroit conference that's usually in June, and their ADAS to Autonomy conference. And I sat through a bunch of the sessions and discussions for that conference. And it's interesting, how like driver assist features, a lot of customers still don't like using those, things like lane keeping assist and blind spot monitoring, which, I would have thought, that's the one that I think is often, it's usually the best, combined with cross traffic alert. Things like the surround view cameras, they definitely like. And what else here? The thing that customers universally disliked, gesture controls.
Which I understand it, but I don't know that I agree. I kind of like the gimmicky gesture controls.
Come on.
I hate the things that everybody. No, this is on brand for me.
Universally are very scathing about frivolous things, and you like gesture control.
Surprisingly, contrary. It's like I was going to say. It's definitely on brand for me to just like completely dislike all the things that everybody else loves, and to like the one thing they hate. That totally makes sense. I'm surprised that they don't. I'm not surprised. It's encouraging to see that they're uncertain about ADAS, and it makes at least half of the people uneasy, because I think that that's really a good slice of reality, and that's what we have to. Everybody's going to have to either get comfortable with, or we have to make the systems better so that they're actually, they're soothing on their own when you put them into sort of self-driving mode. And we're not really there. Although the Tesla owners, I think, as a sort of group, really do love autopilot.
But it works.
Yeah. Well, no other automaker sort of has that quite kind of level of evangelism in its driver base.
But I think that if you queried most or the vast majority of Tesla owners, they would describe themselves as innovators and early adopters, right? And so they're willing to
very much to
take that risk. Like the work I did in Saudi focused on Tesla owners versus Nissan Leaf owners, and those Tesla owners by far and away were willing to take the risk to use technology as new as autonomous, and that was 5 years ago, you know? So I think that that's a given. I mean, I have a Volvo XC90 this week, and yesterday I almost had a heart attack because it thought that there was a car when there wasn't a car, like it around a turn. So as I'm turning, there's a car parked, and all of a sudden I get this loud brake, like I'm, you know, how like right. in a cockpit where it says pull up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, it scared the dickens out of me.
Yeah.
You know, and it happened again today.
Well, that's the other point that the study sort of covered, though, is like many customers are unsure of how to operate the systems or what they can do and what they don't do.
Sure.
And I think that that's true. It's funny. Back when we were commuting, I would, you know, my wife and I would call each other on our commutes, and you know, she would often hear the systems beeping at me. She'd be like, are you going to hit somebody? I'm like, no, it's calibrated. And certain cars are calibrated, so they're very conservative. And just like, I'm totally fine. It's just, you know, making the system nervous. Thinks I'm going to hit the car in front of me that I'm passing now.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the Volvo definitely has an overabundance of systems. And for the most part, they're quite good. Most of them are haptic, first of all, which I far prefer. And I understand, like, if that braking system, it would be very good if, say, I'm drowsy, you know, or it's dark out. But the false alarms are, you know, to your point, Dan, of making them better, the false alarms then just make people want to turn it off.
And especially with lane keeping assist, you know, this is the thing I think that irritates people the most. And you know, it's often what causes me to turn off lane keeping assist systems when they are too sensitive and they give you constant false alarms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an audible alarm.
Right.
You know, the car I'm driving this week is the Cadillac CT5. And, you know, I drove it across the state to Grand Rapids on Friday. And this, you know, it reminded me of, you know, one of the things that GM really did right was coming up with a haptic feedback system in the seat.
Yes.
It actually vibrates the seat. So when, you know, if you're drifting towards the lane on one side or the other, you know, it'll vibrate the seat on that side to give you a warrant, give you an alert. Or if you're backing out of a parking space in a parking lot and somebody's walking down the aisle, you know, detects a pedestrian, it'll buzz the seat, you know, which I think is a great, you know, it's a great way to provide feedback. It's not overly sensitive. I think they did a good job of balancing the sensitivity and, you know, providing you a good feedback mechanism.
Yeah. I think the other really confusing thing is that we haven't settled on a terminology for each of these things. And, right. and even if we have like blind spot monitoring, people don't really know what that means. And I'll, you know, an example is when my sister and her husband were going car shopping, they wanted to buy a gently used, like off lease vehicle. And there were two cars there, two Jeep Grand Cherokees that were basically exactly the same. I think I've told the story before. And basically, you know, one had blind spot monitoring, one did not. And I kept trying to push her to say, look, buy the blind spot monitoring, buy that. They ended up not buying it because they went with the one that they had originally picked out. And the first time that my brother-in-law drove it, he said to my sister, hey, why didn't it tell me the car was there? And she goes, that's blind spot monitoring that Rebecca's been trying to tell you about. And he's like, oh, I didn't know what that
always
was.
Always listen to your wife or your sister.
I'm sorry? Right.
I said, always listen to your wife or your sister.
Come on. I get paid. Well, I don't get paid, but I get. Yeah.
No, you're a car writer. You definitely don't get paid, right?
But, you know, it just reminds us, but it brings it back to that consumer level, right? Of realizing that we are so enmeshed in all of this stuff that the general consumer may still need that translation of what blind spot monitoring actually is.
Well, there's a rush to brand everything so that it all has your own name on it, and that creates confusion. And then there's also just like back to that JD Power sort of study, like finding that people don't know what it does, or don't know how it works. And you know, for some of the higher end cars, there's that that training session that the dealer should give you. A lot of them do, but you know, even that, it's, you sit with the, you know, the person from the dealer for a half hour or an hour while they go through the car, and then you're so overwhelmed because the feature set is so deep that you just, you forget, or you've tuned out halfway through because it's just, it's a lot, you know?
Yep.
And so I don't know how we make that better. And the, you know, the Volvo experience that you're explaining is like, well, that's how they've sort of decided to handle it, is they're going to make the system conservative, and it's going to be really preemptive, and probably, you know, that's good in a way, but also it can annoy the crap out of you.
Well, yeah, because so, the first thing somebody's going to say if they crash is, why didn't the system notify me?
Right, exactly.
Right, so they're going
to. Like, part of it, yeah, part of it is like, well, if it's going off all the time, at least you're seeing the thing you've bought, you know?
Right.
Like, you know, lane keeping systems, I think most people generally don't like because they fight with you. And a lot of them just, they can't follow the lines. The lines on our highways aren't that great, in at least in this region. So they get confused. Some of them are real good. Others, they sort of wobble around, you know, from right to left as they try to stay centered. But you know, I think they're going to figure out what people want and what people don't want. And some of this stuff is going to go away or just get better. So it gets out of the way.
I think it's more, it's going to get better. I don't think most of these features are going to go away. I think one thing that will definitely get better is the branding. You know, as you said, you know, manufacturers have used their own branding, you know, like adaptive cruise control, you know,
Super Cruise, Autopilot.
Toyota calls it, you know, radar cruise control. Hyundai calls it smart cruise control. Nissan calls it intelligent cruise control. I mean, everybody's got their own branding
for the same thing.
So, you know, one of the things that's good is Consumer Reports has really been making a push to standardize the naming of these features. And, you know, there's also, I think we've mentioned it before as well, the National Safety Council has a program called My Car Does What.
Yes.
And there's a website, mycardoeswhat.org, where you can go and you can see all the different features, and, you know, there's explainers on what they do. And, you know, when they launched this a couple of years ago, they actually produce a whole bunch of materials, you know, pamphlets and stuff and posters that they distribute to DMV offices around the country, you know, to help drivers understand what all these features are, what they do, what it means. So, you know, there's this push now to get that standardization of the naming so that everybody's using consistent naming for these features. And I think that'll help, you know, and then combine that with education. You know, hopefully we can get to a point where people are less confused by it. I don't think we'll ever get, you know, completely not confused, but certainly if we can get them less confused so they understand better what the capabilities and more importantly, what the limitations are, then I think that it'll make a difference. Let's jump into some listener questions. So let's start with a question that came in from Snap at Yelly AJ, maybe. I'm not sure how you would pronounce that. But
you
had a question, or they had a question about production of the 2021 Ford F-150. Has it started yet? And when can we expect those on dealer lots? And no, not started yet. They're doing a shutdown. There's two plants that build the F-150 in Dearborn, Michigan and Kansas City, Missouri. The Dearborn plant's going down for 2 weeks, middle of September, and then we'll start production like the last week of September. And then right after Dearborn is done with its changeover, they'll change over Kansas City, and they'll start production, I think, about the second or third week of October. So you should start seeing F-150s hitting dealer lots, new F-150s hitting dealer lots by the end of October.
All right. So get ready.
All right.
The 2021 is probably worth waiting for if you really must have it. There's not a huge gulf between the 2020s and 21s in a lot of ways. They're both really good trucks. If you need a truck, get one. You'll be pleased.
Yeah, I think the big difference, there's actually several big differences. One, the interior on the new F-150 should be much better. You saw it last week, didn't you, Rebecca?
I did, yeah. This is one of the products that they had with the Bronco.
So was the interior better than the current F-150?
You know, I unfortunately, because there's really not Fords in our press fleet, I rarely get the opportunity to drive them. But I will say that this one had a beautiful interior, and they also had a lot of nice small, the emotional solutions that I call them, just finer details of you know, being able to make it, they really thought about making it a work truck along with making it a beautiful vehicle inside and out. So I think, you know, from a cost standpoint, if you're budget conscious, I agree with Dan. I don't think there's a tremendous amount of differences. But over time, those kinds of small things like having a platform for a computer to be able to work, being able to, you know, just the ingress and egress was really easy, both from the cabin standpoint as well as from the truck bed standpoint. And they've just done a lot of really nice, thoughtful features to it, to the 2021.
Yeah, it's a great update. I mean, Ford knows how to make a truck and make it work.
They do.
For everyone. and so.
And you know, you have the hybrid that's also coming up.
Yes.
As well.
Oh, that's true.
Which should be interesting.
That's true. So, yeah, if there's one segment that needs hybrids, that's definitely trucks.
Yeah. All right. Next one from Harvey Simon. Question for me and Dan. Do you consider yourselves part of the auto industry? And the question is prompted by Rebecca's description of herself in the last two shows as part of the auto industry. Quote, we have not done a good job as an industry. And on the previous episode, her wording was similar. We in the auto industry. I thought that folks who review cars to do so objectively could not be part of the industry they write about and therefore would consider themselves journalists. So why don't you go first, Dan, and then I'll respond.
I don't consider myself directly part of the automotive industry per se. I would feel more as part of the industry if I were working for automaker PR, which I could make myself available.
for
the right price.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, to be honest, we're a tertiary industry though, and so there is that understanding of we cover the product and the industry, and we have a close relationship. And you do have to be aware of that so that you don't sort of get too far removed from being a journalist, you know. And I know that it's hard for me to say I'm a full-time journalist too, because I'm stuck out here in Massachusetts. I'm stubborn. I won't go to New York. I won't go to LA. I won't go to Detroit. So that limits my options. I can freelance. I can sort of have it as a side hustle. And I try not to take up too much space for the people who are doing it full-time because those are the folks who really, they are a lot more, they're a hardcore journalist, and they should really, and you see it happen. They cover the industry with the same zeal that a political reporter does and should cover politics. It's their beat. So I guess, yes, I consider myself part of the automotive journalism industry, but not the automotive industry per se.
Rebecca, do you want to add anything to it before I respond?
No, I'd like to hear your response as well.
Okay. So I do consider myself part of the industry. I don't work for an automaker or supplier anymore. I used to. That's where I started my career, working for suppliers as an engineer. And, you know, I've always considered myself part of the industry, even, you know, when I worked as a full-time journalist, which I don't now. You know, it's a part-time journalist, and my full-time job, my 40-hour a week job, is as an industry analyst, where, you know, I study the technologies and, you know, do market research. And the work that I do, the work product that I do, I don't work for automakers or suppliers or anybody else, you know, that would be, it sounds like, that you would consider part of the industry, but they purchase the product that we produce, the research reports that we produce. Just as they also subscribe to car magazines and automotive news, you know, and other publications, you know, to get an understanding of what's going on out in the industry. But even as a journalist, you know, especially, you know, covering, you know, a lot of the technology stuff, I do still consider myself part of the industry to the degree that, you know, especially the kinds of things that we're talking about, you know, it's part of our responsibility to educate our readers, our listeners, our viewers on what these products are, how they work, why they work the way they do. And, you know, we are not salespeople or marketing people or PR people for the automakers, but we, you know, it's our job to educate you about, you know, what are these products? Why do they work as they do? And what should you know about them? And, you know, to the quotes, you know, about Rebecca, you know, what she said about, you know, we've not done a good job as an industry. You know, I think that was probably in our discussion of EVs, right? Or I know you've certainly used that wording in the context of EVs and some of the other things we've talked about on the show. You know, it's all of our responsibility, even when we're not working as for automakers, to help people understand what can an EV do, or what can an ADAS system do for you. You know, that's what we do as communicators, you know, as media communicators, is helping people to understand. And, you know, while, you know, and we try to do that, you know, while not necessarily being salespeople, not promoting, you know, any particular product, but helping them understand what it is about a product that they might be interested in.
Right. I mean, I feel like we're scouts, you know, it's, if you think about scouts, whether it's baseball or basketball or football, they evaluate players, right? And they're part of the industry. And some scouts are independent. Some scouts will work for a specific team, but we're providing a service, but we try, I think, as much as possible to remain objective, which is why we often have a pro and con. Like, I always try and bring up something that I didn't really like about a product. There's rarely something that's completely fawning. You know, a fawning review isn't going to help anybody. And so I think that's one of the things that we try and do is, as you say, Sam, provide that perspective and provide that this is our experience with that vehicle. And while I do feel like I'm part of the industry also. You know, we're enmeshed in it. This is what we've been doing for over 20 years.
Yeah. And, you know, you can be objective. You know, having an opinion is not mutually exclusive with being objective. You know, in fact, I think it's necessary to be objective to have a valid opinion, you know, to have a responsible opinion. I wouldn't necessarily use valid, but, you know, a responsible opinion, you know, to have, you know, for us to do our jobs, you know, we have to give you our opinions, and we have to come at it from, you know, from a position of trying to be objective about it so that it's honest, you know, both, you know, about how we feel about it. And as you can see, sometimes we disagree on stuff, you know, and that's good because, you know, we're all three of us are coming at it from very different perspectives. You know, we have very different backgrounds, very different needs and wants, in a vehicle. And, you know, there's a lot of things we agree on and a lot of things we disagree on. You know, and those are all perfectly legitimate, I think.
Well, I would like to throw it back out to the listeners and sort of, you know, take their temperature. Like, why do you listen? What keeps you coming back? I know part of it is people have learned our personalities and those likes and dislikes and wants and needs in vehicles. And I think part of that is you align yourself to a degree with the opinions that you share, right? Like you know, okay, this music reviewer always craps on this particular band that I like.
I've always said, you know, a movie critic, you should follow the critic whose critics you agree with. Like if somebody suggests a movie and you go and see it, you actually like it, follow that critic, because everyone has a different a different like and dislike. There's some movies that I really like and there's some movies that I don't like. And so
you should also follow critics you disagree with. Well, no,
absolutely. But you know, we each agree. Like I would love to hear more about how our listeners perceive us and what they think about it. But, you know, it, to me, it's just like, if you want to go see a movie, go back to the critic whose movies you actually liked, you know, their recommendations.
Yeah. Or, you know, I'd love to, you know, the journalist thing is just to be like a small child, right? And just keep asking why, and throwing it back. So, if there's an opinion or, you know, some rant that one of us goes on and you want to know more about it, like, you know, I'm very open to that. And I think that that's something that is really healthy, is to be challenged on that. And, I think we do it amongst ourselves too, is just to make sure that we're asking each other, well, okay, why do you feel that way? What is your reason for liking or disliking? I think it's pretty clear why I don't like touchscreens, you know, and I think it's also clear why some people do like them, to me, even though I dislike them, you know. So that's, I think that's where you get the,
and this is an area where Dan and I wholeheartedly agree,
the deeper understanding. But I know, you know, even just putting climate control in auto or using the voice command. I know, Rebecca, you like voice command. I never think to use it. Yeah. And it's fun when it works. But, you know, like, to me, it feels tedious to use. But it's that, you know, there's enough depth to this that I think that's what keeps it interesting. So, yeah, I don't necessarily myself feel like I'm part of the automotive industry. But if somebody wants to change that, let's talk. I'm glad that you guys feel like you're part of the industry. That's good.
But Harvey, thank you for the question, though. That was from Harvey Simon. Yeah.
All right. Next up, from Adam Jekowenko. Something Rebecca said on our most recent show.
You're getting us in trouble, Rebecca.
I know, right?
And it was her mentioning the value of rear cross-traffic alert. We're an EV family and shop Teslas briefly, but we're extremely disappointed to find that such a high-tech car does not offer this
feature. That is amazing. I had no idea it didn't offer it.
Because we find it so valuable. There are so many times that where our Chevy Bolt, which is what we wound up buying, alerted us to things we could not see. I still can't believe that Tesla doesn't offer this feature, and I just don't understand why. I saw someone as recently as a couple of months ago tweeted Elon begging for this feature, and he said he would consider it. It's just crazy to me that it's on almost every car in this price range. And I know it's a bit of a hard stance to take, especially for Tesla fans out there who will and have said to me, just use your camera. But if they never implement this feature, I will never buy one.
Yeah, but the camera, the sensors can see further than the camera. Like, that's the thing that, like, I have a shrub at the end of my driveway, and rear cross traffic alert can often see a car coming that I can't see because there's a shrub blocking both the camera and my view out the back of the car. So when it goes off, I stop and then I see the car go by.
Yeah, the camera's right. Not sufficient. It's not the same thing.
Yeah. Right. And the cameras are also not, you know, on Teslas are not positioned where they could be utilized for cross-traffic alert. You know, so the way cross-traffic alert works, it actually is, it's using the same hardware that's available for your blind spot monitoring. So there's two short-range radar sensors in the rear corners and the rear bumper on either side that they're mounted behind the plastic covering on your bumper. And, or typically they are anyway. Sometimes they're actually integrated into the taillight assembly, but that's another story. And, you know, so when you're backing up, you know, these can actually look out sideways from the rear corners of your car and look down, you know, if you're in a parking lot or a driveway, and look sideways, you know, to see if there's any, you know, to detect if there's anyone, whether it's a pedestrian or a vehicle or a cyclist, coming, you know, towards your path. And the advantage that radar has over a camera is it's much more accurate at detecting speed and direction than cameras are. And, you know, unfortunately, Tesla made the choice that they were going to use just the single radar sensor on the front that they have for adaptive cruise control. And leave it at that. And everything else is done with the cameras and with ultrasonic sensors, which have a much shorter range. And they're not as good at detecting where the object is, whereas radar is very good at that. So it's an unfortunate choice that Tesla made, but almost, you know, this is a technology that's rapidly becoming mainstream standard equipment in mainstream cars, you know, all the way, you know, from base models, you know, for $20,000, you know, all the way up to much more expensive cars, you know, almost all Hondas, Toyotas, Nissans, Fords have it as standard equipment now. GM still, unfortunately, makes it an option on most of their cars, but I think they're probably going to end up moving towards making it standard in the next few years.
I hope so. Maybe if Elon's kid, once he starts to walk, whatever his name is, you know, as he toddles around whatever mansion they're in, maybe something will happen to him and he'll see the value of it.
I hope it doesn't take that.
Well, not that he's going to hit the kid, but, you know, like all of a sudden you realize, like, if something happens to you in your personal life, sometimes then they'll be happy to implement it. Then all of a sudden they'll see the value of it. Obviously, I don't want any harm to come to the child.
There was also a PS from Adam.
Oh, it's a nice kid there. It's going to be a shame if something happened to him.
He says, I also really love satellite radio, particularly talk stations. And the fact that you can't get this easily or implemented well on a Tesla is also deal breaker number two. I just don't understand why they don't implement the simplest forms, simplest of common features like these, as well as Android Auto and Apple CarPlay while they're at it.
Yeah. So satellite radio is like, you have to make the deal with SiriusXM, right?
Yep.
And it cost you money.
Well, and I was talking to Jeff Gilbert on WWJ today, and of course there's no AM radio either in Volvos or BMWs and presumably Tesla.
Tesla has never had AM radio.
Because but what do you do at night? That's like, you drive at night, a long highway drive at night. You want to pick up the stations that are like thousands of miles away with the skip. I would do that. I'd drive from home.
Apparently, Tesla's had issues with interference with their
electric
drivetrain, and I think some other OEMs have had similar issues with electric vehicles and AM radios.
That's true. I will say, I have not had
a tough thing to solve.
That seems like a great plot for a horror film. But
I've not had good AM reception in a car in the last 15 years. That's true. It's just too much. The car itself is just kicking off too much electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Two more quick ones here from Groove. Due to the looming shortage of commas, what are your opinions on Oxford commas? Again, feel free to needlessly get personal on your opinions.
I love this. People need to start following us on Twitter because these kinds of conversations show up on Twitter and they're pretty hilarious.
What's your comma opinion?
Well, so my comma opinion is that I started to say this on Twitter and then it didn't really come out right, but it's like nudity in movies. Sometimes it judiciously moves the plot along and clarifies something, and other times it's just gratuitous. And I like a well-placed comma. So if it clarifies and moves the plot along, and as I said on Twitter, it's the whole idea of I like eating my family and my pets, or I like eating, comma, my family, comma, and my pets. Don't be a psycho. Like use commas.
What was that book? Like Eat, Shoots, and Leaves?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm not... Your metaphor, I'm still stuck in your metaphor. So. Like, is there a point where the comma becomes a hyphen when it gets really heated? Never mind. I like the Oxford comma. Like, I generally like it. I went to Catholic elementary school, and Sister Mary Elephant, like, we had rules. I mean, it's Roman Catholic elementary school. It's just all about rules. And you always, always, always use a comma. Like, you have the Oxford comma. And so in my copywriting
career... Can
we explain
what the Oxford comma is for our listeners?
So the Oxford comma is sort of like it's a serial comma. So when you have a group of three or more, a lot of times what the modern style allows is you drop that last one and you just use and in between. So it's like, I had wheat bread, peanut butter, and jelly. I don't know if that's a great.
No, it's a good example. And then the Oxford, when you use the Oxford comma before the and, like, I had wheat bread, peanut butter, comma, and jelly. But the AP style guide, which a lot of publications use, explicitly says, or it did until recently, I think they've actually just
changed it. Yes.
Said not to put that last comma before the and.
So that drove me bonkers as sort of the copywriting side of my career, because I would run across these, like, you know, paragraphs and paragraphs of website copy or like advertising copy or something. And it would just be rife with that last comma missing. I'd be like, what is the matter with you? Who taught you how to write? Like, no. And I would spend time going back in and like adding them back in, and then I'd hand it off, and the guy I handed it off to be like, what is the matter with you? Who taught you how to write? And he'd take them all out. And I'd be like, no, like, it's not clear. And I think that it's a precision thing to me. Like, you need to break them up. Maybe people just don't like the look of it or whatever. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I don't like about AP style.
Passive voice.
I hate the passive voice, but partly because I'm an advertising copywriter. And so we want action. But also just like as a journalist or you know, somebody who's writing about, you know, the enthusiast press more so than a journalist, like, we want action in our stories. And really, it's not like that sort of classic bell curve to the story. I tend to start off with the Fichtean curve, which is like you start on action and it looks more like a sawtooth. So like the science of how you're structuring the story goes together with the style. I don't know, like, I like the precision of the Oxford comma. It makes my intent very clear. And I don't like the AP style guide so much. I don't like Chicago. My favorite style guide ever has been Elements of Style. Partially because it's flexible. A lot of it's like E.B. White and William Strunk going, yeah, generally do this, but you know, do what you feel. It's very bohemian.
Bohemian style guide.
Yeah. But also it's just like, it's got a lot of good, just common sense and sort of writing for readability, mm-hmm. which is generally where I go. You know, I write for stuff that like is going to be enjoyable to read. I want it to be readable, not tedious. Or if I'm writing, you know, you want to talk about where the writing rules go out the window. It's writing for voice. If you're writing a script to be read or, you know, dialogue to be delivered, oh my God, is the grammar wrong? And I can't tell you how many times I've like handed off a script or something and had it come back with it, like the grammar all fixed, and be like, no, like, you're not going to like it when I pay the actors to deliver those lines for you. Like, please trust me. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I like the serial comma. I like the Oxford comma.
I agree. You know, I think there are times when it is redundant, you know, and it doesn't add any precision, but it doesn't hurt. It doesn't cause any damage by adding that extra comma there.
Right.
And there are a lot of times when it definitely helps eliminate ambiguity about what the meaning is.
I mean, this is the same question, right? So in my house, we have the friction between 12-hour time and 24-hour time.
Really?
Yes.
Do you live with Europeans?
No. But I love 24-hour time because it's
you're
precise.
The weird one. Okay.
I am the weird one. And it's just like, you know, I get a lot of eye rolls. And it's like, but it's A, it's precise. B, it's efficient because you never have to say 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. You know that 3 is 3 a.m. and 15 is 3, you know, 3 in the afternoon. Like, I guess you have to do a little bit of like mental translation, but it just, again, it's precise and efficient.
That's you. That is you in a nutshell.
Except for I am not efficient. I enjoy precision and efficiency. I do not necessarily exude it.
All right. One last one before we wind up for tonight. Continuing the pizza theme from last week.
Oh boy.
What would be your perfect food delivery vehicle?
For pizza or for any food?
The question says perfect food delivery vehicle.
Oh. How about food receiving vehicle? That's what I like instead.
do you mean like you like to get the pizza and then drive around and eat it? That could be a challenge if it's fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, if it's too hot.
Burn the roof of your mouth.
Yeah, that's never fun. I don't know.
Food just, you know, back the tractor trailer up to the driveway.
I'm gonna go with one of those little Ford Transit Connect little vehicles.
Yeah.
Something like
the Transit
that.
The Transit Connect is a good, you know, flexible, you know, adaptable vehicle, you know, to deliver a single pizza or to, you know, cater a whole whole party. You know, it's great. Yeah.
What
know,
was
gives
the,
you a lot of capability.
What was the Domino's car? Was it the DXP?
It was a modified Chevy Sonic.
Yeah.
And they replaced the passenger side rear door, like in the window. They took out the window and basically put in a little insulated compartment and a special door on there so that the delivery drivers could open that up, stick the pizza in there. It would stay nice and warm and, you know, until they got to the delivery and then drop it off. And they still have those around, you know, here in Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, the Domino's stores still have those.
Well, so following on this theme that Daryl or at D King Cole sent in, I would be curious what everyone's pizza delivery cars are today. Like, so when the guy pulls up from my place, it's a little Kia Soul, all decorated out, all wrapped up in their pizza theme from R. Curry's Pizza in Costcob, Connecticut. Some of the best pizza I've ever had in my life. But yes, they have little Kia Souls that run around town.
Huh. I think the last time I had it delivered, it was a, I want to say it was like a GMT 355 Trailblazer or something. Oh. I felt kind of bad for the guy.
Yeah,
I tipped him a lot. I gave him a big tip.
I usually don't get delivery food. I usually go pick it up. So
yeah, you know, I do too. It's just everyone gets it from our curries around here. So I see them buzzing all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They once delivered.
It's usually something old and decrepit, whatever it is.
So I just quickly, our curries once delivered pizza and a bottle of wine to a campfire at my neighbor's for us.
That's awesome.
Isn't that amazing? Like, that was pretty fabulous.
Excellent.
That's great.
That's service.
That's almost enough to get me to consider moving back to Connecticut.
Almost. We will almost welcome you in Greenwich. You'll fit right in.
Yeah, it's about as affordable as Newton.
Hey, the taxes are good.
Yeah. all right. Well, I think we have done a delightful podcast with pizza in another pizza ending. So
keep the questions coming, though, guys. Please, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we love it.
Yeah,
thank you
for sure. And so until next time, you know where to find us. And in the meantime, we'll keep the shows coming. So yeah, reach out, let us know if there's any food related stuff that we can help you out with.
Yep. And don't forget to rate us on wherever you find us, please. That will help as well.
All right. So until next time.
Thanks, everyone. Cheers.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.